We just have a little bit left in our study of the book of Kings, so everybody be studying the list of kings. I'd also like you, on top of knowing the kings of Judah, to be able to tell me a couple of the kings of Israel. And for bonus points, if you can give me three kings in succession of any of the empires around the nations, then around Israel, we'll give you extra bonus points for that. You know what I was cracked up at teaching at ABC when I was there? The moment you offered any extra credit, the requests came pouring in for other things. Like, can we do this for extra credit? How about this other thing? And I just gave you enough extra credit to pass the courses three times. And kids these days. Kids, yeah, right. So, all right, let's go to 2 Kings chapter 25. We looked last week at the destruction of the city, the life of Zedekiah. We compared notes with Jeremiah's book. And Jeremiah is actually also a very great resource in filling in some of the details for this period that we're going to look at too. So we're picking up in 2 Kings chapter 25, verse 22. All right. This is after the destruction of the city and after the deportation of most of the people to Babylon. And here's what's going on in the land of Israel. Verse 22, over the people who remained in the land of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had left. So there were still some people left. Remember, he left the poorest of the land to take care of the farms and fields so that everything didn't get completely overrun. Over those, he appointed Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, son of Shaphan, governor. Now, when all the captains and their men heard that the king of Babylon had appointed Gedaliah governor, they came with their men to Gedaliah at Mizpah, namely Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, and Johanan, the son of Kareah, and Sariah, the son of Tanhumeth, the Netophathite, and Jaazaniah, the son of Maacathite. And Gedaliah swore to them and their men, saying, do not be afraid because of the Chaldean officials. Live in the land, serve the king of Babylon, and it shall be well with you. So here's the call for the people of Israel to stay in the land. These are the people that didn't get deported. These are probably some of the soldiers that remained after the battle and maybe escaped during the battle. And now they're coming back. They hear that Gedaliah has been appointed governor of this region by the king of Babylon. And so they come back, and Gedaliah's message is, of course, stay here. Submit to the king of Babylon. Now, is that what God wanted or no? Did God want them to submit to the king of Babylon? Eldon? Yes, he did. He was very emphatic about this through prophet Jeremiah. Submit to the king of Babylon. In fact, during the siege of Jerusalem, Jeremiah was constantly telling the people, if you surrender yourself to the king of Babylon, you're going to survive this. If you stay here in the city, you're going to die of the famine, you're going to die of sword, you're going to die of pestilence. But if you surrender and go out to the king of Babylon, I will give you your life as a prize of war. Of course, everything else is going to get destroyed, but hey, that's a pretty good bargain to say I'll be guaranteed to survive. So people that believe the word of the Lord would surrender to the king of Babylon. Of course, not many of them did. Most of the people didn't want to listen. And here's something I want to draw out. As we have gone through this series, we have focused upon the failures of the people of Israel. Hey, Pete, would you grab me my water bottle from up there? Thanks. We focused on the failures of the nation of Israel in not obeying the covenant that God gave them. Thanks. I don't think, actually, it's the small one. That's Dan's. Dan doesn't want my water. There we go. Thank you. Excuse me just a moment. I'm really dry. That's going to spill. Okay. But another thing that I want to elaborate on in all of this is that Israel was by no means an irreligious country. Meaning, they were going through all the motions of worship at the temple. They were still singing psalms in the temple. They still talked about Jehovah. The kings still had prophets of Jehovah where they could inquire the word of the Lord. But they also worshipped all the other gods. They worshipped Baal. They worshipped Asherah. They worshipped Marduk. They worshipped the gods of Moab and of Ammon and the Amalekites. So the problem in Israel was not a lack of religiousness or religiosity. The problem was a lack of true religion. Now, I know there's a lot of talk about, well, this isn't a religion, it's a relationship with God, and that's very, very true. But the problem in Israel was not a lack of faith, as we call it, and it wasn't a lack of spirituality. You see any parallels to our day? Is our society a spiritual society? Are they interested in spiritual things? Yes, they are. They actually are quite a bit interested in spiritual things. Our society loves studying religions of the world, and they're very, very emphatic that we should be tolerant and accepting of those religions, aren't they? What is it that our society doesn't want? Christianity. They don't want the true religion. At least not if your religion says all the others are wrong. And here's one of the main distinctions between biblical faith and other types of faith, is biblical faith will come along and say there is no other faith, not a real one. Oh, people will be full of faith. You can't see the air quotes on the recording. All right. People will be spiritually minded. They will be interested in spiritual things, but it will be all the wrong kinds of things. In one account, God appears to the prophet Ezekiel, who at this point is away in Babylon. And in the spirit, God brings Ezekiel back to the temple, and he starts walking him around the temple and showing him all of the idols that have been erected in the temple. Now remember, this is like just 20 years after Josiah died. And Josiah went through and cleaned the whole country of idolatry. But within 20 years, it was all back and in the temple. And there were rooms in the temple dedicated to all kinds of gods, to the gods of the stars and the gods of the sun and the gods of all of the nations around Israel were being worshipped in the temple, and the people of Jerusalem probably hailed themselves as being very, very spiritually minded people. So after all, how could God overthrow us? We're very spiritually minded people. We're very faithful people. We love God. Folks, a lot of people will talk about Jesus. They will talk about the Bible. They will talk about worship. But that doesn't mean that they are biblically faithful. And this is tough because it makes us sound like hard-nosed, arrogant people. But the reality is that we're not being arrogant. God Himself has defined what is the truth and what is error. And commandment number one in God's covenant with Israel was what? I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. That is, no other gods in my presence. The land you dwell in, there will not be other gods. I'm it. For the Lord your God is a jealous God. Meaning that God does not share His glory. He does not tolerate when we worship Him and anything else. And so it is not really spiritual to say, well, I love God and I love this. Because the moment we've done that, we've violated the first commandment. And we've violated the number one commandment that Jesus told us about, which is, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. If you love Him with all your heart, what's left for any other God? Nothing. He gets it all. And so our society's modern mindset, which thinks that all systems of faith are great, is really a very, very unbiblical system. But that's where we're at. We are in the same position that the people of Israel were in. They thought they were spiritual. They thought they were very faithful-minded people. But when it came down to it, every time God spoke to them and told them one thing or another, they didn't listen to Him. So when Hezekiah comes along, and back in that setting, God was saying, do not submit to the king of Assyria. Resist him, I'll protect you. And the people said, no, we want to partner with the king of Assyria. He's so strong, he'll help protect us. All the way back to the Exodus, God has been giving a very consistent command to the people of Israel: do not return to Egypt ever again. But constantly, the people of Israel want to go back to Egypt because they're a strong nation, they're a mighty nation, they're a prosperous nation. They want to join to that because they want to be strong, they want to be prosperous, they want to be mighty. So, Gedaliah tells the people, stay here. Stay in the land, dwell here, but submit to the king of Babylon. So whatever taxes he's going to impose on us, we're going to pay them. And God, through Jeremiah, is saying, stay in the land. You people that have already been exiled, guess what you're supposed to do? Stay there. Seek the peace of the city, whatever city you're in, seek the peace of that city. Plant your vineyards, plant your crops, raise your livestock, raise your children, give them in marriage, you're going to be there a while. Now, all the way back in the book of Isaiah, which was about 125 years before this, God started telling the people how long they were going to be in that land. It's going to be a while. Jeremiah is the one that actually gives it a time frame, and he tells us it's going to be 70 years. So the people are gathering around Gedaliah, and Gedaliah is saying, don't be afraid, live in the land of Babylon, and it shall be well with you. So verse 25, we're going to see again, not everybody is on board with this message. But in the seventh month, Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, son of Elishama, of the royal family, came with 10 men, struck down Gedaliah, and put him to death, along with the Jews and the Chaldeans who were with him at Mizpah. Then all the people, both small and great, and the captains of the... Excuse me, I've got to turn my page here, and I can't get them separated. All the captains of the forces arose and went to Egypt, for they were afraid of the Chaldeans. Well, if you just murdered the governor that the Chaldeans put in place, wouldn't you be kind of afraid of the Chaldeans? Yeah. But here again, what was God's order to them? Stay there. Submit to Babylon. But they didn't do it. And so they ran off to Egypt. That's all we get about this period from the book of Kings. So we're going to jump to the book of Jeremiah, chapter 40. And actually, quite a bit goes on here in this couple of month period. So Jeremiah chapter 40, when the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord after Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, had let him go from Ramah, when he took him bound in chains, along with all the captives of Jerusalem and Judah who were being exiled to Babylon. So after the fall of Jerusalem, all the captives were taken to the city of Ramah, where they were processed. And the captain of the guard was told to let Jeremiah go, because Jeremiah had been prophesying surrender. The Babylonians liked that message, so they said, well, here's a guy that's going to help us out, so leave him here. He'll help keep control of the local population. And so they let him go. And verse 2, the captain of the guard took Jeremiah and said to him, the Lord your God pronounced this disaster against this place. The Lord has brought it about and has done as he said. Because you sinned against the Lord and did not obey his voice, this thing has come upon you. Now behold, I release you today from the chains on your hands. If it seems good to you to come with me to Babylon, come, and I will look after you well. But if it seems wrong to you to come with me to Babylon, do not come. See, the whole land is before you. Go wherever you think it good and right to go. If you remain, then return to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, whom the king of Babylon appointed governor over the cities of Judah, and dwell with him among the people. Or go wherever you think it right to go. So Jeremiah is given free rein. You want to go to Babylon? Go to Babylon. You want to go live with Gedaliah? Go live with Gedaliah. You want to go somewhere else? Go somewhere else. That's a lot of freedom that Jeremiah is given. Verse 6. Then Jeremiah went to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, at Mizpah, and lived with him among the people who were left in the land. And when all the captains of the forces in the open country and their men heard that the king of Babylon had appointed Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, governor in the land, and had committed to him men, women, and children, those of the poorest of the land who had not been taken into exile to Babylon, they went to Gedaliah at Mizpah. And this is a repeat of what we read in the book of Kings. Okay, so jumping down just a little bit to verse 10, we get a little extra information. Everybody's gathering to Gedaliah. It says, "As for me, I will dwell at Mizpah to represent you before the Chaldeans who will come to us. As for you, gather wine and summer fruits and oil and store them in your vessels and dwell in your cities that you have taken. Likewise, when all the Judeans who were in Moab and among the Ammonites and in Edom and in other lands heard that the king of Babylon had left a remnant in Judah and had appointed Gedaliah, the son of Shaphan, as governor over them, then all the Judeans returned from all the places to which they had been driven and came to the land of Judah to Gedaliah at Mizpah, and they gathered wine and summer fruits in great abundance." So here is Gedaliah. He's trying to organize the people, get them to come back into the land, and people are coming back into Judea from the nations around Israel where they had fled because of the Babylonians. So verse 13, though, something starts to come out. "Now Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the leaders of the forces in the open country came to Gedaliah at Mizpah and said to him, 'Do you know that Baalis, the king of the Ammonites, has sent Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, to take your life?'" So this is a plot by the Moabite king to try to take over Israel by killing Gedaliah. But Gedaliah, see how he responds, "Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, would not believe them. And then Johanan, the son of Kareah, spoke secretly to Gedaliah at Mizpah, 'Please, let me go and strike down Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah. No one will know it. Why should he take your life so that all the Judeans who are gathered about you would be scattered and the remnant of Judah would perish?' But Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, said to Johanan, the son of Kareah, 'You will not do this thing, for you are speaking falsely of Ishmael.'" He doesn't want to believe that this coup is running its course. He doesn't want to believe that Ishmael is going to do it. Chapter 41. "In the seventh month, Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, the son of Elishama, of the royal family, one of the chief officers of the king, came with 10 men to Gedaliah at Mizpah. And as they ate bread together at Mizpah, Ishmael and the 10 men with him..." I'm purposely skipping some of their names there, by the way. We can read those. "Ishmael came with the 10 men with him and rose up and struck down Gedaliah with the sword and killed him, whom the king of Babylon had appointed governor in the land. Ishmael also struck down all the Judeans who were with Gedaliah at Mizpah and the Chaldean soldiers who happened to be there." So he takes this place by storm, kills off a lot of people. Jumping down to chapter 42, you can read 41 there and read about the rest of that insurrection. But if you go down to chapter 42, all the commanders of the forces and Johanan and all the people from the least to the greatest came near and said to Jeremiah the prophet, "Let our plea for mercy come before you and pray to the Lord your God for us for all this remnant, because we are left with but a few as your eyes see. Pray that the Lord your God may show us the way which we should go and the thing that we should do." Now, how many of you have ever prayed this prayer before? "Lord, show me what I should do." Probably have, most of us. Get into a situation, we start wondering, "Oh boy, I wonder what I should do here." How does God direct us most of the time? The Word. He's going to direct us in the Word of God. Now, what if there's something the Word doesn't directly speak to? Eldon?
That's when you get a flat nose.
That's when you get a flat nose? Yeah. Yeah. Now, this is a complicated question, and I don't want to delve into the whole thing. I firmly believe the Scriptures are sufficient to answer the question. And if the Scriptures don't answer it as specifically as we would like, it means either we can go either way, or we just don't have enough information yet. But what was clearly God's plan for the people of Israel at this point? Stay in the land, right? Stay put. Submit to the Babylonians. Stay in captivity. So why are they coming asking Jeremiah for a word from the Lord?
They don't want to stay.
You ever ask advice from people and you purposely ask someone that you know will agree with you? You know, you say, "Well, I know that person. I know what they'll say, and they won't say what I'm thinking, so I'm not going to go ask them for advice." We're going to ask these people that already agree with us. Well, they're hoping Jeremiah will tell them, go to Egypt, because it'll be safer there. And so they say, you know, "Ask the Lord what we should do." Jeremiah, the prophet, said to them, "I've heard you. Behold, I will pray to the Lord according to your request, and whatever the Lord answers you, I will tell you. I'll keep nothing back. And then they said to Jeremiah, "May the Lord be a true and faithful witness against us if we do not do according to all the word which the Lord your God sends you to us. Whether it is good or bad, we will obey the voice of the Lord our God to whom we are sending you, that it may be well with us when we obey the voice of the Lord our God." That sounds great, doesn't it? That's the kind of answer you want to have before you preach? Or is that the kind of answer you want to have after you preach? Okay, they haven't heard the message yet. So, verse 7, at the end of 10 days, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, and he summoned Johanan and all the commanders of the forces who were with him, all the people from the least to the greatest, and said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, to whom you sent me to present your plea for mercy before him, if you will remain in this land, then I will build you up and not pull you down. I will plant you and not pluck you up, for I relent of the disaster that I did to you. Do not fear the king of Babylon, of whom you are afraid. Do not fear him, declares the Lord, for I am with you to save you and to deliver you from his hand. I will grant you mercy, that he may have mercy on you and let you remain in your own land. But if you say, 'We will not remain in this land,' and disobey the voice of the Lord your God, and saying, 'No, we will go to the land of Egypt, where we shall not see war or hear the sound of the trumpet or be hungry for bread, we will dwell there,' then hear the word of the Lord, O remnant of Judah. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, if you set your faces to enter Egypt and go to live there, then the sword that you fear shall overtake you there in the land of Egypt. And the famine of which you are afraid shall follow close after you to Egypt, and there you shall die. All the men who set their faces to go to Egypt to live there shall die by the sword, by famine, and by pestilence. They shall have no remnant or survivor from the disaster that I will bring upon them." Okay. So is there any chance that the people of Israel come away from this sermon and say, "Boy, that wasn't very clear. What do you think God wants us to do?" That's pretty clear, isn't it? God wants you to stay put. If you stay put, I'm going to bless you. If you go down to Egypt, you're going to die. Well, what did they already promise to do? Huh? Well, what did they just promise Jeremiah? Yeah, we'll do whatever God tells you, right? Okay. Verse chapter 43. When Jeremiah finished speaking to all the people, all these words of the Lord their God, which the Lord their God had sent him to them, Azariah, the son of Hosheiah, the son of Johanan, the son of Kariah, and all the insolent men said to Jeremiah, "You're telling a lie. The Lord our God did not send you to say, 'Do not go to Egypt to live there,' but Baruch, the son of Neriah, has sent you against us to deliver us into the hands of the Chaldeans, that they may kill us or take us into exile to Babylon." So Johanan, the son of Kariah, and all of the commanders of the forces and all the people did not obey the voice of the Lord to remain in the land of Judah. Not only that, everybody flees to Egypt, but they take Jeremiah and kidnap him and take him to Egypt with them. And so here they are professing their undying loyalty to what God says, but when God actually speaks, they say, "Nope, sounds like a bad idea to me." Okay, this is the ultimate of disobeying Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Fantastic verse. I'm drawing a blank on what it says. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. And don't lean on your own understanding. What does that mean? Means when God gives a command and to you it doesn't seem to make sense, which one do you do? What makes sense to you or what God commands? Okay, that should be where we go, right? This doesn't make sense to me, but God told me to do it, so I'm going to do it. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct your paths. That means I do what I know to do. And going back to that complicated question of how does God lead us, I really think that when we're wrestling with something and we can't decide between A and B which one is the right decision, just keep doing what you know you're supposed to do. And God will make it clear eventually whether it's A or B. You keep obeying what you clearly understand. Maybe you need some more study on the issue in front of you. Maybe you need to keep delving into the Word of God more and more and praying about it and asking God to show you what it is you're supposed to do. But God has given us all things that pertain to life and godliness in the Scriptures. The answers are there. We don't have to have some special tingly feeling coming up inside us. God has given us the answers. The problem is we choose not to do what he told us to do. Usually say, oh, that's going to be too hard, or I'm afraid to do that, or that won't work in my situation because of, and we excuse ourselves like they're doing here. Oh, God didn't tell you that. You're just a pawn for the king of Babylon. You're trying to keep us here under his thumb. Nope, we're going to leave. Well, they go to Egypt. God gives Jeremiah this fun little message. They get to Egypt and they're standing in one of the great cities of Egypt, and God tells Jeremiah to dig up a paving stone from the street, and he digs it up and he buries a scroll there that talks about the destruction of Egypt. And he says, you know what? You came here to escape the king of Babylon, but the king of Babylon's going to set up his pavilion right over this stone. See, I'm burying this scroll here as a witness. Scroll tells of the destruction of Egypt. And he puts the stone back, and some years later, guess what? King of Babylon sets up his pavilion right there after he conquers Egypt. And the people that fled to Egypt are destroyed along with it. So the book of Jeremiah gives us a lot of extra information about what is going on in this interim time here. But we just have a little bit of time left, so I wanted to talk about 70 years. And what's this interim period look like? God did not leave the captivity open-ended. He did say there was a terminus appointed to it. And so we're going to look at our timeline here because this is going to help us. All right. There are a couple of different 70-year periods mentioned. And here's where studying the timeline of biblical history becomes really, really fun. All right. So one of the timelines talks about 70 years you will serve the king of Babylon. And that's in Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 10. He talks about there's going to be 70 years of servitude. Well, Israel came under the servitude of the king of Babylon way back here in 606 BC. Just to review our history a little bit, if you remember Josiah, who rules here, dies in 609 BC when he goes to try to stop the Egyptian army from going up to the Battle of Carchemish. Well, he dies, and so the people of the land put Jehoahaz on the throne. The king of Egypt deposes Jehoahaz, takes him off to Egypt, and appoints Jehoiakim. A couple of years later, Jehoiakim is on the throne, and the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, comes down, besieges Jerusalem, and takes away some captives. At that point, Jehoiakim submits to the king of Babylon, and we begin this 70-year period in 606 BC. From this point onward, Israel is subservient to the king of Babylon. Even though they have a king sitting on the throne, they are a vassal state. They can't do anything they want to do. They're not free. Their king rules in name only. Babylon's in control. And that's going to be shown to be true a few years later when Jehoiakim rebels against the king of Babylon, and Babylon has to come back again and attack the city again in 598. And that's when Jeconiah is king. All right. So Daniel and his three friends and many other people are removed to Babylon in the year 606 BC. And that begins this period of serving the king of Babylon for 70 years. Well, guess what happens? 70 years later, let's do some math. If you're going 70 years into the future, what year are we going to wind up at? 70 years after 606 BC? Remember, you're BC, so you're counting down. 536. So we're going to go forward 70 years to 536 BC right here. Babylon gets destroyed in 539, the city of Babylon. And in 536, a guy named Cyrus takes the throne of Babylon for himself and becomes the leader of a new empire called the Medes and the Persians. At that point, he issues a decree that releases everybody to go back to Jerusalem. 70 years later, Cyrus releases the people from their captivity to the king of Babylon. And if you remember, Isaiah has this fantastic chapter, 100, what is it? It's almost 200 years. 200 years before this guy comes to the throne and says, I'm going to name my servant by name that's going to release you from Babylon. His name is Cyrus. Okay. Fall of Babylon is a fantastic story. Not story, Gary. Sorry, wrong word, right? Fantastic historical account. That's just so much longer to say. But it, if you read in the book of Daniel, when Daniel's an old man, it says that the king of Babylon, Belshazzar, was throwing a huge party, and a hand appears and writes on the wall, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. Okay? And nobody can read it except Daniel. And Daniel says, well, it means this. It means your kingdom has been weighed in the scales and found wanting. And I forget the exact wording there, but destruction is coming. And that chapter, that account ends by saying that very night the king of Babylon was slain. So here's what's going on. In 539 BC, Babylon, the city of Babylon, is being attacked by Cyrus and the Persian army. And Babylon was a massive, massive city. It had walls 400 feet high, some of the towers. The walls were so thick you could drive two chariots past each other without bumping wheels. I mean, this was a well-defended city. It had a second set of walls inside the main set of walls. A river ran right through it with gates barring the passage of the river so that nobody could go in, but that also meant the city had ample supply of water. Between the two walls of the city, the outer wall and the inner wall, they had farms. So guess what? You can grow all your own food. How long can you last a siege if you can grow your own food and have an ample supply of water? You can last a long time. And walls that are that thick don't easily break when they're battered by battering rams and catapults and things. So how are you going to get into that city? Cyrus diverts the Euphrates River. He digs a canal, and he diverts the entire river. So guess what? The water level in the rivers go down, and his army is able to march under the wall. The guards in Babylon were so intent on the party that Belshazzar was throwing that night, that Daniel speaks about, they didn't lock the gates of the river. And they marched right in. The enemy marched in, destroyed Belshazzar, the royal people. He let Daniel live. But he takes over Babylon, and a couple of years later, he is declared the sole king of Persia. And it's Isaiah 44 and 45 that talk about Cyrus by name. And that's one of the great glories of God, is that he knows the end from the beginning. So 200 years before it happened, he's able to say, guess who I'm going to use to destroy Babylon? I'm going to use my servant Cyrus. And he names him. So Babylon falls, and in 536, Cyrus issues his decree for people to go back and rebuild the city and the temple, and that ends the 70 years of servitude. Okay, there was another 70 years, and it was called the 70 years of desolation, and it's talked about in Jeremiah 25. And the 70 years of desolations begins in 586. The servitude begins back here in 606 BC. The 70 years of desolations begins in 586 BC when what happens? The temple is destroyed. 70 years of no temple. Because the people of Israel weren't worshiping in the temple as they were supposed to, God takes the temple away from them so they can't. So in 586, the temple is destroyed and begins 70 years of desolations for Israel, with no temple. Now, if you were doing a little bit of math there, you probably said, wait a second, 536 BC was the year Cyrus issued a decree to go back and rebuild the temple. That's only 50 years. So where's the 70 come from? Well, Cyrus issued the decree to go back and rebuild, but guess what? They didn't. They went back to the land. If you read the books of Ezra, and I'm thinking of Ezra and Zerubbabel. Okay, you read those books. Nehemiah went back later to rebuild the wall. You read the book of Ezra, And they ran into some problems. They started gathering material because Cyrus had issued this decree giving them the authority to rebuild the temple and repopulate the city. And they go back, they start gathering material, but then people start resisting them. And the king of Persia, the next king of Persia, Ahasuerus, he starts telling them to stop building the temple because he's afraid that they're going to build the temple and rebuild the city and start rioting again. So another decree comes out to stop them, but that gets overthrown by Darius. Because eventually the people of Israel write to Darius and say, look, we were given permission by Cyrus to rebuild, but we've been told to stop. This is kind of like our Supreme Court decisions. You know, do you listen to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals or do you listen to the Supreme Court? How it ever came about that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals applies to the whole country, I'm not sure. That's why we have circuit courts. It's supposed to only apply to that circuit. But somehow they write these decisions that apply to everybody. So, you know, our politicians make decisions, and then the courts say, no, you can't do that, and then we got to wait for the Supreme Court to come out with a decision. So that's kind of what's going on here. Cyrus, in 536, issues the decree to go back and rebuild the temple and repopulate the city. He doesn't mention anything about rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, because that would make Jerusalem a strong city and a city capable of rebellion. Okay? So that's an important distinction to make. Cyrus' decree does not does not allow the people to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And you can read about the decree of Cyrus in Ezra chapter 1. So they have a period of time here from 536 BC where nothing's happening, but guess when they finally finish the temple? Ezra notes it for us in chapter 6, verse 15, the sixth year of Darius, the first. And we can date these things. So they rebuild the temple, lay the foundation, get the temple back up and functioning again in the sixth year of Darius, which is 516 BC. Well, let's do some math. What year was the temple destroyed? 586 BC. It's rebuilt in 516 BC. How many years is that? 70 years. 70 years of no temple. 70 years of desolations as the people of Israel can't worship God at the temple the way he told them to because he said no. So, you have 70 years of servitude to Babylon. Starts in 606 BC, ends in 536 when Cyrus decrees that everybody can return. You have 70 years of desolations where the temple is destroyed from 586 BC until 516 BC when they rebuild the temple. So those 70 years are important epochs. God told the people of Israel that they would be punished for 70 years. And it came to pass in two different ways they were punished. By serving another nation and by having no temple where they could practice their idolatry. So we have come to the end of an epic study. We've been in this study for just about 5 years now. I think I started this pretty shortly after I started here. And we've wrapped it up. Are there any questions about anything in the Book of Kings that you've been wondering about? Eldon.
Okay, I'll start back where you left off here.
Okay. Yes, Zerubbabel and Ezra rebuild the temple. Oh, great question. All right. The temple is founded. Whoop, where'd I go? The temple is refounded in 516 BC. That same temple lasts until 70 AD. It stands for quite a long time there. That is the second temple. It's the temple that Jesus came into. Although Herod the Great started a massive rebuilding project, remodeling project. And he beautified the temple. It took him a long, long time to do it. It was carried on by his son as well. So the second temple stood for a very long time, another 550 years or so. Does that answer that?
Yes.
All right, great.
Temple
Okay. No, we call it Herod's temple, and Herod just remodeled the existing temple. Now, he made so many transformations to it that we call it Herod's temple. Because he didn't tear down the one that was there, but he so altered it by improving it and expanding it and putting palisades and porches along it that it looked very little like what Zerubbabel's temple did. Yeah.
The one that was there before was much grander than the one they put up.
Yeah.
After the fall to Babylon.
Yes. Yeah, Zerubbabel's temple was much less glorious than Solomon's temple because they didn't have the gold to overlay everything. It was a little smaller. And so some of the people that had seen Solomon's temple, it does say they wept when Zerubbabel laid the foundations. A lot happens between this point and the New Testament. I mean, we can study Nehemiah and his effort to rebuild the walls. Nehemiah doesn't actually come to rebuild the walls until... trying to think where it's at. It's something like 400 and... There it is. The 450s. So it's another 125 years before Jerusalem is able to rebuild the walls. Okay, and by that point, the Persian Empire is in full swing. Any other questions? All right, now don't forget, in 2 weeks, you got 2 weeks to study. We'll have our final exam. It is an open book exam, so you can have your Bibles with you. No Siri or Google Assistant, though. Okay, you'll have to actually look up answers. No Cortana either. All right, it's an open book exam. And so we'll have some questions, and if you guys pass the final exam, you'll all be masters of Old Testament history. Eldon?
Does that mean I can't put post-it notes on Gary's back?
There you go, yeah. I don't want to see Eldon looking down, trying to hide his hand. It's open book, Eldon. You can have as many notes with you as you want. I don't mind. There you go. Yeah. Any other questions?